Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Red Sea Podcast, part of the Over the Monster Network.
Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
Hosted by Jake Devereaux.
It's gone! It's into the bullpen! This game is tied! This game is tied! David Ortiz! David Ortiz! David Ortiz!
And featuring Keaton DeRosier.
It's a grand slam! I'm telling you!
Welcome back to the Red Seat Podcast. This is your host, Jake Devereaux, and today joining me for episode 243 of the show is Keaton DeRosier of Over the Monster and the Dynasty Guru. Keaton, what's going on, man?
Not much. Hanging out, finally back in my apartment.
Nice.
Doing a pod with you. Feels good. Feels good to be home for a bit.
Yeah, back in Chi-Town. That's good.
Yeah, just in time for the Red Sox to come to town. Going to the game on Tuesday, which is Beatles night. Pretty pumped.
Did we say Beatles?
Yeah.
Like the band?
Yeah.
So what are they going to do for it? Is there going to be like a Ringo Starr bobblehead or something?
I have no other information other than I saw it was Beatles night, and I was like, that sounds like a fun one. Let's do it. Scooped up tickets for Beatles night. So I have no understanding of what that is other than just I assume Beatles themed. They'll probably play Beatles music. I feel like I should maybe like dress up as a Beatle, maybe.
Or a blue meanie.
What is that?
Have you ever seen the movie The Yellow Submarine?
No, I have not.
Oh, you should do it. But don't do drugs.
But I did go through the entire Beatles rock band in one afternoon.
Ooh. Solid game there. Solid game. All right. Well, we aren't here to talk about the Beatles, but we are here to talk about your Boston Red Sox today. We're going to be touching on, you know, all of the recent happenings with the team. Things are going a little bit better. It might not be super reflected in the standings here, but, you know, there are some positive trends here for the Red Sox that we're going to be talking about today, which is going to be a nice, refreshing difference from the last few podcasts that, you know, we've been talking about how the sky is falling. So let's just get right into it here off the top. The Red Sox just won a series against the Astros, one of the hottest teams, one of the best teams in baseball, you know, a team that was just in the World Series last year. Astros are just damn impressive, man. The way that they've been able to develop these pitchers who seemingly came from nowhere in Framber Valdez and Luis Garcia, and the way they keep finding hitters like Jeremy Peña and other guys like that. It's just a great club. So very impressive to see the Red Sox get a couple wins against the Astros. I know you covered this yesterday with Bailey, but like, what's your broad feeling taken away from taking 2 out of 3 from the Astros and winning that series?
Yeah, that felt great. It felt like the Rangers series came at the right time, and that was really kind of like the get right series. Got the bats going. Struggling team. Enrique Hernandez has been on fire, which we'll get to in a bit. Trevor Story is kind of turning around. The offense really kind of rounded into shape, and even in game two, which you know, obviously didn't really which was tough to watch, but there was a lot of positives to take away from the offense there too. You know, they were able to score 4 runs. We're still hitting the long ball, stringing hits together. They had nearly as many hits as the Astros did. They just couldn't get anything kind of timely together. They were 2 for 14 with runners in scoring position, stranded season high 27 men on base. But, you know, we're still putting things together, even though they were, you know, at the time, you know, pretty far out of it. And then obviously in games 1 and 3, offense still looked really great. And that was a team that at the time coming in, you mentioned it won 12 of 13, the second best record in the American League. We knew it was going to be a pretty tough battle, and the Red Sox were up to the task. And that was something that we hadn't seen to this point yet, them really kind of putting up a fight against a good team. Not only putting up a fight, but actually getting a serious win against a really good team. They had been struggling to even put up a fight against bad teams. So they have the really good series against Texas, get the offense going in the right direction, kept that momentum going against a really good team in the Astros, win that series, back-to-back series wins, and it seems like things are now going in the right direction.
Yeah, there's still a lot of work to do, obviously. The team is sitting here as we're recording during the first game of the Seattle series, but Red Sox are 15-22, still a .405 winning percentage. You know, 12.5 back of New York at this point, but you got to be happy with a couple of the things that happened in that series, and especially looking back to game one, Garrett Whitlock turned in another pretty good start, 5 innings, 2 earned runs against a really tough lineup, and then we had that massive rain delay, and I think that one of the things I was thinking, you know, during that rain delay, and I didn't stay up for the whole game because, you know, I had to work early in the morning, but when they came back from that rain delay, it was just huge. So obviously the Martinez doubling to go ahead, and then Bogaerts getting up to plate, up to bat right after him with Martinez on second base, and hearing re-sign Xander Chance, and that was pretty crazy. So I just wanted to read a quote here from the recap of this game on ESPN, but it said after a 98-minute rain delay, he heard a healthy chant of re-sign Xander, and Xander says, "Yeah, I heard it. I just told myself, I said, listen here, brother, don't strike out, put it in play and see what happens. Just don't strike out." And, you know, lo and behold, Xander comes up and hits that home run, putting the game away. Game ends up being 6-3. That was huge. The whole thing was just really cool. I love that fans are just getting behind this guy. And it seems like one of the things that's really starting to happen around here is that even the mainstream media, like, you know, sports radio around Boston, is really starting to harp on the whole, like, you need to get this guy signed thing. And it was kind of interesting because you and I, Keaton, have been pushing this narrative of you need to take care of Xander first in order to have a chance at Devers. And I even heard somebody on like regular sports radio, like one of the hosts, say that the other day. So I think it's really starting to pick up steam. And I have to think that this is putting some additional pressure, especially the fact that, like, you know, Xander's over here carrying a 157 WRC plus at this point in the season, which, I mean, if he carries this pace, which is obviously a little bit unlikely, that'll be the best offensive season he's ever turned in. So it's getting harder and harder to ignore the noise here. And especially he came out and said to Pete Abraham over the last week, he said, "I don't know how this could work, but if they talk to Scott behind closed doors and it's something that's fair, he can come to me. We'll see how that goes." So he's even softening his stance of negotiating with the team during the year. And I know that Boris came back after that and said that, you know, there'll be no negotiating during the season. But, you know, at the end of the day, Bogaerts is Boris's boss in this situation. And we know how the first negotiation went. He basically told Boris to go get it done. So I have to think that, you know, the pressure, the way he's performing, and the fact that this dude is desperate to be here. Like, Bogaerts really, really freaking wants to be here. I'm feeling a little bit more hopeful about this situation at this point.
Yeah, this is something that just doesn't happen in Boston. Like, everybody being on the same page and, like, pointing at the team and, like, are you going to do it? Like even the fan base was pretty split on like what to do with Mookie. Like, there's none of that with Xander. It's like, guys, get it done. Like, everybody's on the same page apparently, except the Red Sox, which is like maddeningly frustrating. I haven't seen anything that's like, yeah, just let him walk. No big deal. Let him walk.
It seems like the pressure is coming from everywhere, too. Like, TC had had Bloom on during, I don't know, one of the games recently, and even mentioned the re-signed Xander chance to him. I mean, he's getting it from every which way. I mean, I heard Will Fleming on the radio the other day saying that, you know, if you're not going to build around this guy, then who the hell are you going to build around? You know, he's literally the perfect guy on and off the field. So, I mean, you're right. The city, the media, everyone is unified that they need to get this done. I mean, hell, Ken Rosenthal wrote a national piece like, why are we talking about this? Why hasn't the team gotten this done already? No one understands. And I feel like that mounting pressure coupled with this rough start to the year, all of the pressure is on the Red Sox to get this done at this point.
Yeah, 100%. 100% it is. And I think I really don't know what kind of twist it kind of put on the pressure, but the poor start, and then there was a couple national people that were like, well, now the Red Sox are going to be compelled to trade Xander Bogaerts at the trade deadline if the Red Sox are, you know, still really bad. It didn't seem like that, at least from where I was sitting, like, I didn't notice that change the narrative much. It was still like everybody that was commenting on it was like, this is doomsday. This is stupid. No, this is not going to happen. This can't. No. And like, just absolutely rejected it as a possibility, even if the Red Sox weren't doing well. So it's just kind of funny that, like, there's no possible scenario where people can imagine him not being here, even if the Red Sox aren't good.
Yeah, and it's just such a different situation than the Mookie thing, where Mookie was just, like, very, very clear about the fact that I want to set the market at my position. You know, I want to go out there and get this huge deal. That's not Xander at all. He's not saying that whatsoever. He keeps talking about fair deal, like, just fair contract. That's all he wants. All he wants is a fair contract to stay here. And I think it's super duper important to Xander to play in one place. And he's talked about that over the last few weeks too, that like nobody does it anymore. It's been a goal of his for his entire career to stay in one place. I gotta think that the Red Sox are gonna be able to get something done. And I don't think it's gonna command, you know, the offers that Correa was asking for, what Francisco Lindor or Corey Seager got. I really don't think that it's going to take that to lock him up here. I think if you give him something that is remotely close to those guys, doesn't have to be what they're making, I think it's going to be really, really easy to sign this guy. He's desperate to be here. Yeah. You don't get too many guys like that.
No, I mean, it should be, that's for sure. And particularly now, there's literally no excuse with him being open to negotiations during the season. Like, initially he was like, no, I just want to focus on the season, let's get through it. Now he's like, no, actually, you know what? I want to be here and I want to get it done. All roadblocks have been completely removed from his point of view now, like his perspective. And now it's literally all on the team. The only reason for them not to get it done is because they're actively choosing not to get it done.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So I think that it just goes ahead and ramps up the pressure even more. So
yeah.
They dropped the second game in the series to the Astros, but the third game of the series was a really, really good one. I mean, they got pounded in game two, 13-4. So I guess we should talk about that a little bit. We'll talk about that in a minute. I want to keep it positive. So we're going to jump ahead to game three here. But Nick Pivetta, man, he turned in just an incredible pitching performance. First complete game for the Red Sox since 2019 when Sale pitched a complete game against the Royals. Very impressive stuff. You know, he's commanding the curveball all night long. Slider was good. Fastball had crazy life up in the zone. But this is not just a one-off thing for Nick Pivetta. I looked into his numbers today a little bit, and over his last five starts dating back to April 26th. He's thrown 31 innings, has a 2.03 ERA, striking out a batter per inning. He's got 31 strikeouts and just five walks with just one home run allowed over that time period. He's been absolutely killing it since he had the really rough start to the season. You know, the first three starts of the year, he gave up four runs, five runs. And since then, he's just been really, really good. What's impressing you about Pivetta? Is this what we can expect from him going forward? You know, how are you feeling about this?
You know, it's really taking the wind out of my sails of calling him Nick Pivetta when he's going this well. And it's a bit of a downer for me as the as the resident low man on Nick Pivetta. It's a bit frustrating. But hey, you know what? I'll admit when I'm wrong, and I'm kind of excited about it. Because as you pointed out, I mean, this is crazy good. And you know, something that was a bit, I don't know, out of character, but I mean, the walks were a little weird, right? Last year, a bit elevated compared to his career. And we were kind of waiting for that to fall back in line because last year, the year that he was having, that was really the only outlier. Or not really the outlier, but everything was going really well for him except the walks were kind of just out of line with the rest of his stat line. And now this year, he's kind of got all of that back together. And as you pointed out, over his last 31 innings, he's not walking anybody. 1.45 walks per nine to go along with the strikeouts and just the dominant performance in the first complete game. That was wild. First complete game since 2019. That I would not have guessed that.
Yeah, it just doesn't happen anymore. It's kind of weird, but yeah. I think you nailed it with the walks, Keaton. I'm looking at his walk totals. First game of the year, three walks. Second game of the year, two walks. Third game of the year, four walks. And then he did have four walks in his first sort of good start here as he started to turn things around. But in the four starts since, one walk over four starts. That's really incredible. The command has been the thing with him. He's been talking about mechanics and that being a big thing that he's worked on. And, you know, I remember that you and Bailey touched on that a little bit on the podcast as well, that he's just a very mechanical pitcher. And that's something that he needed to get right. And it just seems like Pivetta is one of these guys that just needs to throw more in order to figure things out. And, you know, he's getting that run, and it's super important to this team, especially the timing of him doing this at a time when, you know, Nady Eovaldi is struggling a little bit and Rich Hill was sort of on the shelf for a little bit of time and Michael Wacha's on the shelf. So provided a whole lot of stability at a time where the Red Sox really didn't have a ton in the rotation and kind of kept things going well on that front.
Yeah, since that April 26th mark, Red Sox three best starters, Pivetta, Hill, Wacha. What I would have guessed coming into the year.
No, not at all. So I guess it's time for us to get to the bad news about Eovaldi getting the crap pounded out of him in game two against Houston. Went 1 2/3 innings pitched, gave up six earned runs and five freaking home runs, zero strikeouts. Nick Pivetta is getting, Nate Eovaldi is just getting hammered by the long ball this year. He's given up two home runs in his first start, two in his second start, one in his third start, two in his fourth start, none, then one, and five. Five home runs. That was one of the craziest things I've ever seen. I know that Nick Pivetta has had trouble in the past with the long ball, but like, that was kind of weird. And now I've been looking at his numbers and I've been looking at this page for a while. And since he got to Boston, three of his four seasons, including this one, I guess I should say, he's had home run to fly ball rates in the 20%+ marks.
Yep.
And last year it was all the way down at 8.2%. Like, was that the fluke? Is Nate Eovaldi really just like home run-itis, dude?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's this bad. I mean, this is a little absurd.
It's crazy.
But yeah, I think it's got to be a Fenway thing, right? Because there's no really other, there's no other explanation for it. But then, yeah, last year was just crazy good. But yeah, so as we were doing the pre-cap last night, I was skimming his page to try and find something that stood out. I couldn't find anything that stood out. Was trying to do a little bit of a deeper dive here before we got on this podcast, and I still couldn't find anything that makes sense on Fangraphs or Savant to tell us why this is happening. The only thing that I can see is the meatball swing percentage is up 8%, but his zone swing percentage and zone percentages are identical. So he's throwing it in the zone just as often, and they're swinging at pitches in the zone just as often. They're just apparently swinging at meatballs more. I don't get it. Nothing makes sense as to why this is happening. Like, I really don't get it.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, he's a pitcher who has really good control. So he's always in and around the zone. He has a very high CSW, called strikes plus swinging strike percentage. Over the last 4 years, that's been right around the 28% plus mark. It is kind of odd. But it seems like just the fact that he does have this fastball that is a little bit hittable, and it comes in really hard. I mean, dude throws like 97 as a starter on average with his fastball. It's just, I guess it's a recipe. If you're throwing it over the plate and it's not exactly where you want it, if the command on it isn't perfect, you know, you're going to get punished sometimes. And
yeah,
it certainly seems like he's getting punished a little bit more than we'd like him to, obviously. It's hard for me to get super worried about it, though. The hard hit percentage is really high right now, 39.4%. Last year, it was 27.1%. And, you know, his other years in Boston, it's been a lot more similar to what it is now in terms of the hard hit rate. But I just think he's a better pitcher than this. I got to think there's a fix.
Yeah, it seems like it's just a little fluky right now, and it'll kind of regress to, he's probably more around the 20%. The 8% definitely is an outlier.
Yeah. But
nearly 30% is also an outlier. 20% seems like it makes a lot more sense. You and I have talked about him. I mean, we've been doing this podcast for several years now.
Yeah.
He's very effective when he's working in the zone. That's where he gets his strikeouts. So he's naturally going to kind of give up that contact. It's just how he's pitching to the contact. And when he's not as sharp, then he's going to run into some gopher balls. But he generally makes up for it with his velocity. And his velocity it's not really off. There's nothing that's really a red flag there. Five homers in an inning is certainly wacky. So it just kind of, I don't know what to make sense of it right now, basically. If it continues, if in a month he's still at 30%, then something's going to give. There's got to be something going on there.
It's also
right now, it
weird.
Just feels really, really weird.
It's also extra weird because of the run environment right now. Like, it's harder than it's been in years to hit home runs. The balls are dead, yet he's allowing a career high 3 home runs per 9 innings. Like, what is that? It's just very strange.
Yeah, it actually reminded me of, as I was saying that, one thing I did notice, his chase percentage is actually up from where it usually is. So his where he's giving up the most contact is actually outside of the zone, which is very uncharacteristic for him. So maybe that's it.
Yeah.
But that's, that's not really where the meatball action happens, so I don't really know. But yeah, this is chase percentage is up 2%, but the chase contact is up 5%. So people are making more contact on him outside of the zone, but he's always been more effective when he's in the zone anyway, so maybe that's it. Maybe he just needs to go back to being more in the zone. On the whole, the whole line just doesn't really make much sense as to why it's this bad.
Yeah, it's weird. I wonder, do you think if this sort of continues, and I know that if we look at his whole time here with the Red Sox, he's definitely had some home run problems over his tenure here. And does this impact Red Sox management from trying to get him locked up to an extension here after his deal runs out this year? I mean, he's one of the guys that we've been chatting about, you know, whether he's going to be part of the future or not. He's been very injury prone in his career, but he seems to have really found how to manage his body here at 32 years old. And was one of the better pitchers in the American League last year. So, you know, I'm not sure he's a guy you want to close the book on, but with these issues, it does seem like you might not want to give a guy like this, you know, $150 million contract, because there are some real signs here that, you know, there could be some issues with the home run rate and, you know, possibly some other things. And I think you need to worry a little bit about how Nathan Eovaldi is going to age, given how hard he throws the ball and given his injury history and all that stuff. So if you're Chaim Bloom, does this change the way that you're approaching Nate Eovaldi, or what's your preference with him? I mean, it feels early to talk about this, but I think that Nathan Eovaldi would really be one of the first guys to go at the trade deadline if the team is out of it. So we're going to have to start talking about this pretty soon, I think.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree that it's probably too early, because I think that you really kind of have to see how he regresses back to, I guess, and then I'm also, you know, assuming that he does regress back to something like 20%, because that's kind of where he's been in his time with the Red Sox. And if that's the case, I mean, he's been really successful at that 20%. So I think you kind of take that as the norm and go from there. He'll be 33 next year. So I don't know about giving 150 mil to a 33-year-old whose healthiest seasons have come, you know, like right now. I guess it depends on the length, I suppose. But it still feels like I don't know how much, you know, his first 8 starts would affect how things look. You know, when assuming, you know, this is only like a third of what he'll probably end up starting. I mean, I didn't realize he had over 30 starts last year. That's crazy. I assumed he was probably going to be in like the mid 20s. So this would be like a quarter of his starts if he assumes, you know, we assume he goes the same, pitches the same amount as a year ago. A lot can change in that amount of time. So it still seems really early, but if at the end of the season or at the trade deadline, he's still at like a 30% homer rate, I mean, the rest of his line is not going to look very good at that point. So you'd have to kind of assume that this was some age regression, and a portion of these results would be kind of who he would be going forward. And so I would definitely think that would affect it. But I also, it just feels like such out of character that I feel like this is going to regress back more in line to where things are. So it does feel too early to talk about it.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. Just like Eduardo Rodriguez was an interesting guy for the Red Sox, I think, you know, whatever happens with him, it's going to be interesting contract-wise. I was just looking at the numbers, though, from the time that Nathan Eovaldi got here in 2018 to present day. And what would you guess his ERA over that time period is with the team?
4.3.
4.13. So a little bit worse than that. He's thrown 394 innings. Over that same period of time, so 2018 to the end of 2021, Eduardo Rodriguez actually threw almost 100 innings more than Nathan Eovaldi and had a lower ERA, 4.11, over that time period, and was worth a few WAR more than Nathan Eovaldi over that time period. So Eovaldi, I'm not sure how big of a contract he's actually going to command in the market, considering the fact that, you know, Erod was more durable than him and achieved better results. I know that he had the one great season last year, Eovaldi did, but, you know, Erod's a whole hell of a lot younger, and he didn't command a huge contract either. So do you think he ends up getting more or less than a guy like Erod got last year?
I kind of think less. They're like on a AAV. Erod was 4 years younger and got like $3.5 million less on an AAV perspective. Yeah. So I got to think that this next contract for Eovaldi would be less than that.
Yeah, it just seems like the Red Sox might be able to, if they want to, lock him up for something pretty reasonable. I think less than the deal that he is playing on for the team right now. Less than what Dombo gave him. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. It's interesting. He's not a guy I'm wedded to by any means, and certainly somebody I'm not going to, you know, cry about if he gets traded, if the team's out of it, but, you know, definitely an interesting guy to be thinking about here. Moving on to the rest of the rotation, though. So Rich Hill looked okay in his return. He's pitching tonight and isn't looking great, but not looking terrible. Michael Wacha, though, comes back Friday. When Michael Wacha comes back, the team is going to have to make a decision with the roster, though. Who do you think the team ends up removing from the roster for Michael Wacha to come back and be a part of this team?
Good question. Are they going to have to make a decision, though?
I believe so, because I think right now they've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Yeah, 14 pitchers already without Wacha. So they're definitely going to have to do something there.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the rotation, not just the overall roster.
Oh, no, they're not going to have to do anything with the rotation. Yeah. He's just going to slot right in behind Hill. But
yeah, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, no, but they have way too many pitchers on this team right now, and they're still carrying a three-man bench. So, I mean, who goes, presumably from the bullpen, who goes?
Yeah. Well, my guess would be Schreiber, I suppose. He's got three options.
No, I mean, way.
He hasn't done that. Yeah, he hasn't done that.
He's been
that
really
bad,
good.
Though. I mean, I'd be fine with just tossing Brazier to the Wolves, but they seem to love him.
Brazier and his 6.08 ERA and his hard hit rate that's among the worst in all of baseball. Yeah, I'd be fine.
Yeah, he still has an option left, too. But that's the thing, is that they just don't seem to want to let him go, which is just the weirdest thing. But that would be the move that I would make. Trying to think of what their actual move would be. Usually they just send the guy that they just called up back down. So that would be Schreiber, right? So,
yeah.
But that, I would like him to stay.
I don't think there's any way they're going to send Schreiber down, considering how he's performed so far. I would love to see it be Brazier jettisoned. You know, I would be fine with it being Salamora. I don't want to see them let go of Tyler Danish, and it's not because, you know, he's been overwhelmingly good or anything, but he's thrown strikes when he's been up here. he's been hit a little bit, but, you know, 12 strikeouts to two walks. I think that that's important for this team. And, you know, he's a guy who can go multiple innings too. And I think that's important for the way that this current rotation is set up. So yeah. If I'm Alex Cora, I'm kicking Brazier out, closing the door.
Same. We'll see if it happens though.
Yeah, I kind of doubt it, but you know, tis what it is. All right, let's get to the offensive side of the ball. So you mentioned that part of the reason for the team's success lately has been a couple guys coming out of their slumps, and Kike and Story looks like they're coming out of it a little bit. There's also been quite a bit of movement about the first base position. Cordero's really drawn a lot more of those starts recently. But let's talk about Kike first. So over his last 6 games, not including tonight's game, he's really turned things around. I mean, he's not tearing the cover off the ball or anything, but he's batting .280, .345 with a .360 slugging percentage. Still not hitting the ball tremendously hard during that period of time, but 105 WRC plus, collecting some hits here. Do you think we're close to seeing Kike really kind of break out of this, or are you still pretty concerned about him?
No, I think this is him finally turning around. I think the success of the rest of the lineup is kind of starting to bleed. You know, that success breeds success. What is it? Rising tide lifts all boats.
That's
mentality.
It,
yep. I think all those boats are being lifted, man.
Well, I hope you're right. I want these boats to be lifted. And one guy I'm pretty sure is definitely being lifted is Trevor Story. So he's really turned on the power recently. And we know that one of the hallmarks of Trevor Story is that he's a notoriously slow starter here. But over the last, what is this, since the 10th, so that's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, including tonight's game, 9 games. He's been pretty red hot over those 8 games that I just mentioned, from the 10th to the 18th. 137 WRC plus, .483 slugging percentage, a couple home runs, 3 stolen bases. We're starting to see that really, four including tonight. Yep. Yeah. Another home run tonight as well. So, I mean,
two
dongs. He has 2 dongs already.
2 2-run dongs tonight. He's got all 4 runs for the Sox.
So,
2 homers in his last 2 at-bats.
Yeah, so I guess this totals up to 4 home runs. I mean, the guy's red hot right now.
Yeah.
It seems like Story's really turning this thing around.
Yeah, he may be that rising tide lifting all those boats.
You're really hammering really that analogy into the ground.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I really am.
I think that, you know what? The analogy has run aground.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, really, it's probably, if we're going to run it into the ground, it's probably Devers and his .500 batting average over the last 2 weeks. That would be that rising tide. But yeah, no, they're all, everybody's got it going, obviously. Yeah, the 2 dongs tonight from Story feels great. Now he's got 3 at Fenway Park, and he's settling right in to just like we all expected he would here. So it just feels great. It feels great to have this offense doing what we all expected them to do, and really kind of take some of the pressure off the, you know, the holes in the bullpen. So yeah, it feels good.
Yeah, I mean, if you can get Kike going to an acceptable level, in a 105 WRC plus is acceptable. It's definitely more in line with his career norms than what we saw from him last year when he was pretty exceptional. But if you can get him to be that or a little bit better, you know, that's fine. We need to still get Verdugo going, but with Story hitting this well, you know, you can start to see a way that you can carry that dead weight at the bottom of the lineup, though. So I want to talk about a couple of the other situations, the situations that are definitely more difficult fixes at this point in first base, catcher, and right field. Christian Vasquez has a 64 WRC plus, really not a lot of power, not a lot good going on there. Franchi Cordero, 81 WRC plus, no home runs so far. He's at least getting on base. Bobby Dalbec, 46 WRC plus, not really playing a lot these days. JBJ, 50 WRC plus, and Christian Arroyo, 45 WRC plus. So that's a whole lot of holes that this team is still carrying. At least Franchi's getting on base. I still think that that's going to be like a pretty fatal flaw, especially because there's just not a lot of fixes for this stuff. I mean, when is it time to actually address this with JBJ and Arroyo and Wright and with, you know, the ugly first base platoon? When is it time to call up Casas and Duran and just let them play? Because there's no way that they can be worse than what the hell's going on right now, right?
Well, Duran, I would do now. The way he was tearing up AAA, I will admit I haven't checked in on his line since they sent him back down. He was, the changes that he had made to his swing seemed like they were really working. Just running all over the place. Had a triple in the game that he came up here at the major league level. I would love to see him get regular at bats and just see what happens. I think he can play left just fine. Verdugo can play right. And JBJ can be a late inning replacement. I don't think he should be getting every day at bats. And I just want to see what Duran can do. So I would say now for him. Casas, it seems like he still needs a little bit. So maybe give him another month, see where he's at, and maybe reevaluate there. I've been pretty impressed with Franchi. You know, the overall line, 214 average isn't great, but the 306 on base percentage, double digit walk rate, his strikeout rate's only 20%. That's great. He's turned in really, really solid at bats this time around, and it's still a small sample, but he's still hitting the ball hard, and he's had really, really quality at bats. He really looks like a different dude at the plate this time around. And I have a lot more confidence in him. And it's not just like a, oh, great, Franchi's up, automatic out, here we go, anymore. I really feel when he comes up to the plate that he's going to have a really solid at-bat and something good is going to happen. He has a really nice at-bat with Trevor Story. Trevor Story got on ahead of him, drew a walk, stole second, and Franchi just put the bat on the ball, went the other way, drove him home with a single. It was beautiful baseball to watch. And that is something that the bottom of the order just hasn't had in a really long time. So I think he's a great fit, and I'm fine with him basically just riding that out, seeing how long that lasts, and then kind of revisit Casas in a month and see if he's, you know, taken more to AAA and that seasoning has helped. Obviously, the power's there, but you want to see a little bit more plate discipline, get the strikeouts down a bit there from Casas. So maybe reevaluate him in a month, and Duran, I'd say now. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you on Duran. I think he's continued to be really good at AAA. When he came up here, he didn't look overmatched either. It was a very, very small sample size. But
yeah,
I think that you need to push that button with Duran, even if it makes your outfield defense a little bit worse. Play Duran in left field, move Verdugo over to right field. I don't know why they're hesitant to do that. I think they should, but you know, whatever. I think that button needs to be pressed, but I don't share your optimism about Franchi Cordero. I know that he's coming up and he's giving these longer at-bats and he's getting on base, but he's such a huge guy. Like, he's got 70 raw, at least, and he just doesn't get to his power. You know, like, looking over his career, the guy has 13 home runs in his entire career. 500 plate appearances, 13 home runs for a guy that size that swings the way that he does. And I just don't think that, like, that's the solution, you know, because Casas, what's Casas really good at? He's really good at walking and he's really good at connecting with power because he's just a mammoth guy. So I think that Casas already is a much more complete player than Franchi is and can already give you more than you know, good Franchi. What we're seeing is good Franchi from him. And it's still just, it's not really what I like.
It's fine for the bottom of the order, though.
It's fine, but is fine good enough to keep this team from the dregs of the American League East?
Yes. If the rest of the order is doing what they need to do.
But why do we need to accept it, Keaton? Why can't we have better?
I mean, we can always have better, sure. But, yeah, I mean, if the top six is doing what the top six should be doing, then one person doing fine in the bottom three is a massive upgrade.
I agree with that. But the Duran thing, I mean, you can't have three positions where guys have WRCs well under 100.
Yeah.
You just can't do correct. That.
Yeah.
So they gotta at least push some buttons, and they're not going to be able to push a button at catcher because that is just way too important of a position, and they don't have anything internally to push. So there's nothing coming at catcher. Like, Vasky is what he is, and he's going to be there. So you got to push a button with one of these other two positions.
Yep.
More good news at AAA, though. Brian Bayo made his AAA debut and looked extremely good. I have his numbers right here. And he went 6 innings pitched. Gave up 2 earned runs, 1 home run, struck out 10, walked 1. And this is, you know, coming off a season here where he's been electric. I mean, he's had 7 starts this season, 39 2/3 innings pitched, 52 strikeouts, just 13 walks. He's been fantastic. He's only allowed 4 home runs. He's been really, really good. Brian Bayo is definitely living up to the hype. He got a little ahead of himself the other day by saying he wants to be even better than Pedro Martinez, which, okay, I mean, buddy.
You can want, but
yeah, you can want that. But, I mean, the kid's good. He's really electric. He's got great stuff. Do you think that Bayo ends up being a factor for this team? He's 23 years old. Does he come up and impact this team out of a bullpen role or, you know, some other role? They could certainly use an arm like this, but with him being, you know, your top starting pitching prospect, I wonder if the team might be hesitant to use him out of a relief role.
I mean, I don't mind in a relief role if the intention is then to turn him into a starter next year. I mean, we've seen that with a bunch of top prospects, you know, across the league. They usually debut as a reliever in the first year that they get their first taste of major league action, you know, just to get used to major league hitters in a short spurt, just to get a feel for the strike zone and the competition, and then they, you know, get into it as a starter. So I wouldn't mind it, especially if they can turn him into, like, some kind of, you know, if they can get, like, 7th, 8th inning. You know, I don't want to throw a rookie into the 9th inning immediately. That'd be a little absurd. But, you know, if they can ease him into it and then start getting, like, maybe 7th, 8th inning appearances out of him, at the end of the season, just to see what's going on, I don't mind it. But I don't want that to then, you know, turn into like a big thing of should he stay there or not. I think he absolutely should be given the run to be a starter. But I don't know about soon, but because, I mean, this was just his first taste of AAA. But I mean, if he continues this level of success, I mean, this first start was really good. So if he continues that going, I mean, I think at some point he's just going to push their hand, right? And then finally they have some depth here. So that just feels really good. So it feels like if he continues to be this good, then it's going to happen this year. And I really wouldn't mind that being in the bullpen.
Yeah, I'm only okay with it in the bullpen if the team is able to get themselves back in this race. You know, if they come to July, early August or something like that, and they're truly contending for one of these wild card spots and the team is back over 500 and feeling pretty good about themselves, then I'm okay with pressing that button and having him come up and pitch some relief innings for a team that's battling. But I don't want him to come up for anything more than a cup of coffee this year if the team's out of it. I don't see a ton of benefit to that outside of just getting a little bit of experience here. I want to see him continue to get innings and stretch out. So he looks good. I mean, this looks like the guy who could come up and break the curse of Red Sox pitching prospects just not panning out. So I'm hopeful.
Dig it.
Yeah, looks real good. All right, let's go ahead and move on from this to our listener questions before we get on out of here. Gordon Comstock has our first one. He says, if you could pick one player not named Wander Franco or Vladdy to have traded out of the AL East so you don't need to see them for however long they're under team control, who would you pick? So I guess it does matter here a little bit about contract length as well.
Yeah, that's a fun question. I think the first ones that came to mind for me were like Shane McClanahan, Shane Baz, those two. They're really good pitchers. I don't really want to see them for like a decade. I mean, chances are since they're in Tampa, we won't have to. But I mean, at least right now, it's 6 years. But that's a long time. They're really good. Those are probably the guys.
I think you could also throw into that mix Alek Manoah from Toronto. Yep. Who's under team control for a while. He's just filthy. And Bo Bichette. I mean, you know, Bo Bichette's a pretty damn good player. I think he's a player that could easily warrant some MVP votes at some point over the next few years. So not having to worry about Bo would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So, I think on the position side, I go Bo. On the pitching side, I go Manoah because he absolutely murdered us last time.
Yeah, I'll go Bo and McClanahan.
Nice. Love it. Good question. That was a really fun one.
Yeah.
Next one comes from Ivan L. Apex, and he says, is Xander the greatest shortstop in franchise history? You know I love these questions. This is great. Or is it still Nomar? Nomar has 9 seasons, 1,281 hits, 279 doubles, 178 home runs, 690 RBIs, 6 All-Star games, 1 Silver Slugger. Xander Bogaerts has 1,285 hits, 278 doubles, 145 home runs, 626 RBIs, 3 All-Star games, 4 Silver Sluggers, and 2 rings. So he outlines the resumes here. What's your take on this, Keaton? Has Xander done enough to eclipse Nomar?
Well, see, I was going to defer to you because you are the historian.
All right.
That was going to be my go, but since you asked me, let me look at, pull something up real quick. So what's the Xander Bogaerts about the same, what was the length of the year for him? He's in his 9th season now, right? Yeah. Or I guess 8th. Well, so Nomar's got a 40 war. So if we try and factor in the defense there, Xander's 11 war behind him right now. So I guess if we factor in the defense, I think I'm going Nomar still. Yeah. Offensively, they're pretty close, but defensively, I think I got to go Nomar.
Yeah, I think so. I had to make this choice when I did my all-time Red Sox team, and I did put Nomar ahead of him. And I think that Xander hasn't quite done enough to go ahead of Nomar yet. However, I fully expect Xander to go ahead of Nomar by the end of this season. I think this is all he needs to finally eclipse him. Xander at the end of this season, well, by June, at some point in June, is going to be the all-time leader in games played at shortstop for this franchise, which is really remarkable considering, you know, the life of this franchise. And I think that he's an incredible offensive player, definitely still not as explosive an offensive player as Nomar was at his peak. But I think the thing that Xander has over Nomar is just he doesn't miss games. He's incredibly steady, really, really poised hitter. The defense is not as good as Nomar's, but Nomar was definitely prone to some bonehead errors as well. I remember watching many a Nomar jump throw that did not make their mark. So he definitely made some more difficult plays than Xander, but at the end of his career, especially if Bloom doesn't completely screw the pooch here, Xander Bogaerts is going to go down as the greatest shortstop in the history of the team.
Bold.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's that bold, but
probably like not it. That bold, but yeah. Number two should be up on that that right field facade at some point. That would be wonderful. All right, well, that's a fitting way to end this podcast, Keaton. I am glad that we were able to save this recording. We had a little snafu in the middle of it, so for all the people there, there was a little bit of a close shave, but we got it out to you. So, Keaton, thank you for your recording wizardry, and I'm glad that you're home with your cats.
Me
and your too. Girlfriend.
In that order. Thank God she doesn't listen.
Yeah, it would have definitely just gotten you in the doghouse there by putting the cats first.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, take care. And everybody, thanks for listening to us. Rate, review, all that stuff. Shout us out some questions if you want to. You can find Keaton on Twitter at The Spoken Keats. You can find me at Dev Jake, and you can find Over the Monster at Over the Monster. Thanks for listening.